You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 20th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Ireland's Taoiseach stands down early and unexpectedly. Europe continues to agonise about whether it's okay to spend Russia's money on Ukraine, and you might not know it to look at them, but the Finns remain officially Earth's happiest people. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Yossi Meckelberg and Alex von Tunzelmann, will discuss the day's big stories. And we'll talk to the author Sasha Eisenberg about his new book on how to win elections in an age of disinformation. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Alex von Tunzelmann, the historian, author, and screenwriter, and by Yossi Meckelberg, Associate Fellow with the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Yossi, you have recently been to Norway and Saudi Arabia. That must have been a challenging pack.
Yeah, it's 28 degrees difference and in few days, but a very different experience. Much has to do with what's going on right now.
Well, I would think they were very different experiences. Are you allowed to tell us why you embarked on this bizarre itinerary?
In Riyadh, as you know, I write for Arab News in Saudi Arabia, which is the English newspaper, and there was a huge media meeting, conference, which actually looked into the business side, the technological side and content sides, how they all merge and change, mainly in the Middle East. And part of the changes they take generally in the Gulf and more openness within the media. So this was...
Well, that's climbing over a low bar in terms of more openness in the media in Saudi Arabia in particular.
It's a journey. It's not a journey. You know, always when talk about gender equality, and it's a journey that's embarked with the 2030 plan. And it's moving towards that. As every country, they need to go through their journey. The newspapers are more open. It's more inclusive in terms of who can write in the newspaper. But is it where, you know, if you compare to Western media, some better than other. But that's exactly the journey. I think we should look that it moves in certain direction, more to expect also to reach the destination that we think is right.
Alex, you have ventured somewhat closer to where we are now sitting.
Yes, I've just been in Oxford doing some teaching. I'm afraid it's nothing like so glamorous as going to Saudi Arabia.
Teaching in Oxford is pretty glamorous.
It's all right.
Oh, it's all right. Whom were you teaching and where were you teaching it and what were you teaching them?
I was teaching at University College and some lovely American undergraduates who come over here to do a semester abroad. I was teaching various things, but last night gave a lecture on statues, question in Oxford.
Did you recommend a book they could perhaps read?
Well, a book called Fallen Idols by Alex von Tunzelmann is available in all good bookshops. I think they particularly appreciated it because in University College there's a very famous, rather kitsch, if you ask me, statue of the poet Shelley, an old college alumnus. And he's sort of pictured in, you know, as if having drowned with a large kind of in a sort of marble pit with, you know, quotes from Adonais and gold around the top. And the students, I think, were particularly delighted that I suggested that as part of the sort of current alteration trend towards statues, this could be turned into a Shelley Memorial ball pool. If you simply fill it with coloured balls and let students play.
Well, let's start with the idea of making Russia pay for what it has broken in Ukraine. This has been a thought at large for just over 2 years. It has this week been endorsed by the EU's High Representative for Foreign Affairs, Josep Borrell. He wants to see 90% of revenues generated by Russian assets frozen in Europe diverted to the European Peace Facility, the mechanism which reimburses EU states for weapons delivered to Ukraine. There appears a certain elegance to this, as well as natural justice, effectively making Russia buy the weapons with which Ukraine will defend itself from Russia. Yossi, first of all, these assets, which are frozen in Europe, generated in interest and other revenues about 4.5 billion euros last year. This is a lot of money. Do we like this idea?
Well, first, I think $3 billion is not necessarily a lot of money when, if you think about that, one shell of 155 millimeters of artillery is more than $8,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, make the wars are very expensive. So, the best way to solve it is to have peace. But, you know, this money is the question. They use basically the profits, the revenues that come out of it. So they keep the assets there and see what happens after the war when the war eventually is over. Now, we have to be careful because at the end of the day, those are Russian assets. So we need to look at when the war is over. Also, the reconstruction not of Ukraine, but depends what happens in Russia, and assume that one day there will be a president not called Putin in Russia.
This is Russia, Yossi. It might be somebody worse.
It might be somewhere worse, but you know, going to talk about happiness later, let's stay a bit optimistic. That might be someone better, and lose this asset also to change Russia. Not going back to the mistake of the First World War of just punishing Russia, using the money to help Ukraine A, win the war, B, rebuild Ukraine, but also then at certain point to think, can we also use some of these assets to change Russia for the better?
Yeah, it is important to be clear, Alex, that no one's really talking about seizing the assets themselves. It's the interest and other revenues they have accrued. But that is an argument that Yossi has just laid out there, and it's quite a difficult one to argue with, that these assets do not belong to the Putin regime, but they belong to, well, the Russian nation. And presumably, if you accept that, then you have to accept that the revenues they generate belong to the Russian nation. I think that's the other side of the argument. I'm honestly not sure what I think.
Yeah, I mean, it is a complicated one. I think, you know, Yossi referred to First World War. This is the spectre that will loom large in the minds of people who are worried about this, is the Versailles Treaty at the end of the First World War, where Germany was forced to pay enormous reparations. And generally speaking, historically, you know, to cut a long story short, effectively, that led to a very, very dire economic situation in Germany, which then, of course, led to the chaos that brought forth Nazism as a political force. So there's a great deal of fear about sort of imposing very high reparations or payments on countries and what the long-term effect of that is. And I think it's right to be cautious about that. But also, I do think this is a different situation. You know, we can't necessarily say, well, that means that, you know, we can't use any of this money, because actually this is we're not talking about a complete asset stripping here. I think it's very important that, as you say, those assets, in fact, remain. And it's a question of what you do with the interest and the revenues.
Is there a slippery slope here argument as well, Yossi, or a slippery slope argument here, that if this precedent is established, then, you know, do Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya send Europe and the United States a bill?
But you see, the difference, there are no much of assets, for instance, in Afghanistan.
Well, indeed not.
And that you can do that. I think also we have to remind ourselves that these assets were first and foremost were stolen from the Russian people.
Also true.
By the same people, the oligarchs. Mm. So in a way, it's almost kind of a very belated justice of returning some of these assets that post Cold War were by a small group of oligarchs were stolen from the Russian people. But again, I think, as I said, I think we have to look at any case on its own merits. Some country can actually go and pay reparation because they just don't have it. And actually, we need to go, in the case of Afghanistan, of helping them to develop. Because at the end of the day, when we look generally at foreign aid, this is not charity. This is a political tool. Mm-hmm. It's an international relations tool to achieve world peace, to achieve a better world. Development is a tool to ensure peace. So we have to look each case on its own merit.
I mean, is there a thing here, though, Alex, that this might be all we have? Because I think even if and when Russia is defeated, it's very unlikely, Russia being Russia, that we will see the kind of justice that I'm sure Ukrainians and most Europeans would want. It's very hard to imagine that you will see the Russian high command in the dock in The Hague or at any other kind of tribunal. And it's very hard to imagine any subsequent Russian regime saying, yes, sorry, that was on us. Where do we send the check? Whereas this, you know, is a way of extracting some measure of justice for Ukraine and ensuring that Russia does end up taking some responsibility.
I mean, I think that's exactly the argument for doing it. And of course, you know, you can take various positions on this, but that lays out rather clearly what the rationale would be. We, of course, the big problem at this point is that we really can't see into the future. And just as we don't know what sort of leader, there will be some end to Putin at some point, simply because nobody lives forever. So, you know, it doesn't look like he will step down anytime soon, having just won his election.
Comfortably.
Very free and fair election. He's certainly not going anywhere right now. But, you know, eventually, I'm afraid, time catches up with all of us. So there is going to be a post-Putin period, and we don't know what that will look like. And actually, I think it's extremely hard to predict right now exactly what that will look like. It depends how long this all goes on and what happens. But yes, at some point, one would hope that you could think about actually returning some of these assets to the Russian nation, whatever nation that is at that time.
Alex and Yossi, we will have more from you both shortly, but now to the Republic of Ireland, which will shortly be advertising for a new Taoiseach following the surprise resignation of Leo Varadkar, who has held the post since December 2022, following an earlier stint from 2017 to 2020. And I'm joined now by Pat Leahy, political editor of the Irish Times. Pat, I called it there a surprise resignation, but how big a surprise was it?
I was a complete shock to everybody, to be honest, around here. Very few people had, if anybody had anticipated anything like this. Rumours began to fly around, as they do early this morning, that a major announcement was imminent. But even then, rumours tended to centre on other members of the government rather than Mr. Varadkar, for the very good reason is that people very rarely, if ever, give up the job of prime minister unless they are forced to. But Mr. Varadkar has broken the mold today anyway with this announcement. He said it was for personal and political reasons. The political reasons are a little bit more easy to understand, I guess, in that his party has been weak in the polls. Government has tended to lack any sort of forward momentum, and his party was getting increasingly nervous. Many of its MPs were declaring their intention to retire at the next election. For all that, though, this still comes as a huge shock, although focus, as it always does in politics, I suppose, is moving pretty quickly to who his successor might be.
We will come to that, but is it possible that these recent referendums are in any way a factor? This was these two referendums on attempting to modernise certain sections of the Republic's constitution, which were soundly thrashed by the public vote a couple of weeks ago. I mean, it never looks good for a government when they call a referendum and it doesn't go the way they might have anticipated, as we know all too well here broadcasting from the United Kingdom. But is that really likely to have been a factor in his thinking?
Look, if it was, I don't think it featured to any significant or decisive degree. You're right, of course, that losing referendums, particularly by the margin that the government did, is not a good look for any administration. And Mr. Varadkar himself was very closely identified with these referendums and with the decision to run them when he did. At the same time, not an awful lot hung on the results of those referendums. The changes to the constitution were largely symbolic, and it's very clear that lots of loyal government supporters decided to vote against them. I don't think that their votes are in danger come the general election. But I think what perhaps reinforced is the sense that Mr. Varadkar maybe had just lost the political touch that he had early in his career, when people tended to see him as, you know, a straight talker, as someone who told it as it is, who wasn't really like other politicians. And that was a great advantage. That public perception was a great advantage to Mr. Varadkar before he became Taoiseach for the first time, and was probably instrumental in his kind of rapid rise through the ranks of his party, Fine Gael, to the Taoiseach's office. But, you know, when you're prime minister for a few years, it kind of dawns on the voters that actually you are a politician. And I'm not sure Mr. Varadkar ever kind of managed really to reinvent a Varadkar 2.0, if you like, for himself, to kind of take him into that more mature phase in his political career.
He has been leading this curious coalition of his own party, Fine Gael, with Fianna Fáil, those being the Republic's two grand old establishment parties, plus the Greens. And this, of course, is something that was basically jerry-rigged in order to keep Sinn Féin on the opposition benches after the last election. Is there any doubt at all about that coalition holding together? Will they serve the complete term?
So the process that will take place now is Fine Gael will pick a new leader, and then Mr. Varadkar will resign as Taoiseach, as Prime Minister. Now, when he resigns, his cabinet are constitutionally deemed to have resigned. So there will have to be a new Taoiseach elected and then new ministers appointed and approved by a vote of the Dáil. Both Micheál Martin, who's the Fianna Fáil leader, and Eamon Ryan, who's the Green Party leader, were very clear today that they expect the coalition to continue. There's only at most a year left in the coalition's term of office. There has to be an election before this time next year. So my guess is that the three leaders of the coalition, the two that I mentioned, and whoever the new leader of Fine Gael is, who will go on to become Taoiseach once that coalition agreement holds, is that they're likely to decide to stay as long as possible in government. And I think one of the outcomes of today, or one of the consequences of today, is that all that talk of an early election, which was very much around the place in recent weeks, is likely to take a back seat.
Well, just finally then, the inevitable and big question, and we won't necessarily hold you to this, but from where we're sitting right now, who does look the likeliest next Taoiseach?
Well, I'm glad you won't hold me to this, because we've precious little to go on at the moment. I suppose, understandably, none of the likely candidates are getting into the business of declaring themselves. The Fine Gael parliamentary party is meeting right now, not far from where I'm talking to you here in Leinster House. And I think from tomorrow on, we'll begin to see candidates coming out. I think the front runners at this stage are assumed to be the Minister for Higher Education, Simon Harris, Minister for Public Expenditure, Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Enterprise, and former Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney. I think those would be the big three. If two of those get into it, that's probably as much as we're going to see. I think the early money is probably on Mr. Harris, although he's a lot more inexperienced, I guess, than the other potential candidates. So, look, you know, I guess we'll know a lot more about that tomorrow.
Pat Leahy at the Irish Times. Thank you both. Thank you, rather singular, for joining us. Let's bring both our panel in, was what I was attempting to say there. Alex, if we contemplate the legacy of Leo Varadkar, whatever else he has done or hasn't done in office, he's kind of an important signifier of a changed Ireland. I mean, if I think back to when I first started going to Ireland a lot in the early 90s, the idea that at some point, actually not too that far in the future, that the Taoiseach would be a gay man of Indian descent, and more to the point, almost nobody would find that interesting or remarkable, would have seemed absolutely extraordinary.
The right of a gay man of Indian descent to be just as boring as all the other politicians is very important to establish. Absolutely. And I think, you know, and I mean, he has been a that's a bit mean, because he has been a recognisable figure, I think, and somebody who also has appeared a bit on the world stage. I mean, we saw him in Washington just a few days ago making this sort of St. Patrick's Day appearance and White House breakfast and all of this, some sort of, I believe they call it a shamrock ceremony.
I'm vaguely wondering if he just flew home from that and thought, I cannot do another one of those.
Yeah.
St. Patrick's Day in Washington, D.C. You actually are, in fact, the Taoiseach of the Republic, must be horrendous.
Yeah, I was once in Boston for it, and that was a lot. all calling it Patty's Day and dyeing rivers green and so forth. Very confusing. Anyway, nothing like what happens in Ireland. But certainly, you know, I think he has had an impact, and it's an interesting moment for him to go because, you know, the general wisdom on political careers is that they all end in failure, mm-hmm. Unless they're cut off at some happy juncture. And he has cut it off himself at a, I mean, you know, yes, the referendums, but I mean, really, I would agree with Pat's point there, really, that this, you know, that was pretty minor in the terms of the general story of, you know, of the history of Ireland in recent years. And perhaps it was slightly foolhardy of the government to bring forward those referendums at this precise point, and of Pradker particularly to do so. But I don't think those will define the record. I think people will look at a longer period where, and actually, you know, he's been pretty successful overall.
Yossi, I did like the fact that in his statement, Leo Varadkar said that he understood that there would be speculation as to the real reasons he was going. But he said that, you know, these are the real reasons, which is obviously what he would say. I just wonder with people in his position. And I'm thinking now of what New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said before she resigned. Do we often underestimate just plain tiredness as a factor? These people, after doing that job for quite a substantial period, you can imagine that somebody could just wake up one morning and just think, I'm done, I'm cooked.
Yeah, and it's exactly the example I had in mind. It's especially the relatively...
Great minds, Yossi.
And it's because I think they're relatively young. They can think about, we can do something else.
Should I put it gently?
Yeah, if you're Joe Biden, you think, if I can stay as long as I as a president and I'm not looking for another career. And you think to say, I took the country as far as I could.
Mm.
And I did it. And say symbolically, the fact that, you know, a gay man or for Indian, it means there is no... It's a first. There is, it's set mm-hmm. a precedent. It's important. So it's normalizing it, which is so important. Then I think, yes, you're getting tired. You know, we all say sometimes after kind of intense period of time, oh, we need a holiday. We need to go away from the job. This is a 24/7 job and with a lot of pressure. And then this and think, I think the referendum must have played some role mm-hmm. in that. Because it's also about the idea of dual relationship, what the definition of a family. And so it must have, if I can't pass this kind of changing in the constitution, goes back to 1937, is there a point for me to stay? And so I think that's probably played on his mind. But I think it's refreshing when you see so many leaders that keep going, despite you know they can't take the country one inch forward, but they still insist there. This is refreshing.
Well, moving along to the ongoing fallout from the other week's Oscars, honestly, this was all so much more straightforward when it was just someone reading out the wrong name or climbing out of the audience to belt the host. The speech with which Jonathan Glazer accepted his Academy Award for Best International Feature for his film, The Zone of Interest, has suffered the traditional fate of attempts to express mildly nuanced opinion about the Middle East, i.e. large numbers of people affecting theatrical outrage as opposed to perhaps having a bit of a think about things. More than 1,000 signatures, the authenticity of some of which is debatable, have now been appended to an open letter denouncing Glazer's remarks. Here is the allegedly controversial bit.
Our film shows where dehumanisation leads at its worst. It shaped all of our past and present. Right now we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. Whether the victims of October... whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all are victims of this dehumanisation. How do we resist?
Yossi, shortly after he gave that speech, the clip that went viral, obviously edited in monstrous bad faith, was cut off as him just saying, we are men who refute our Jewishness and the Holocaust, which I'm pretty sure is not actually what he intended to say. And actually, when you listen to the whole thing, isn't even remotely close to what he actually said. But did you think anywhere in those remarks there was anything especially outrageous?
I think it was more clumsy than outrageous. Because, again, I have the quote in front of me. His criticism, of course, of Israel and what's happening in Gaza, again, you know my opinion about this.
We do.
So I'm not very far away. I don't understand. Why do you have to refute your Jewishness? This has nothing to do with that, especially when you just directed a very successful movie about the Holocaust. I'm not so sure it was the right stage for this and the right way to put it. If what Netanyahu, for instance, represents and says, I have monopoly on Judaism, and the Jewish state, Israel, has monopoly and representing every Jew, he basically, I think, trying to say, no, I'm Jewish, and I have a different opinion, and I don't want anyone to have monopoly not on Jewishness and not of the what we learned or what we didn't learn from the Holocaust. But the way he put it, again, I see it's very clumsy in a way that he said, I refute my Jewishness, and then, so, okay, so what's the point? He's entitled to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, he can refute whatever he likes. But then when he goes there in relation to the Holocaust being hijacked, this is a completely legitimate debate, how you approach the Holocaust. And yes, I agree that some people in Israel, definitely Netanyahu and his lot, try to hijack the debate and see it in a very, very narrow prism.
Alex, by coincidence, we recorded a conversation earlier about how the right or wrong phrase in a particular context can make all the difference, and listeners do tune into the Foreign Desk on Saturday for that. But is there an argument here that Glazer could basically have phrased this a bit better? Did it sound like he was equating the war in Gaza with the Holocaust? Was he not clear enough about what he meant by occupation?
No, I don't think those are the problems. I think actually the problem is just the sentence structure of the beginning of the sentence, which is overcomplicated, because what he said effectively, had he phrased it as, I refute the use of my Jewishness and the Holocaust to support this occupation, you know, that would have been clearer. But because he switched those words around, so we refute our Jewishness and the Holocaust being used, et cetera, you could cut off the end bit. And
which
that was sort
happened.
Of the problem, because that's what immediately happened. So, I mean, it's actually this kind of microscopic phrasing issue, because I think it's perfectly clear when you read the whole quote or listen to the whole quote that he's not refuting his Jewishness. He's refuting the use of it in this context. However, you know, he's not stopping being Jewish. And it means the opposite of him stopping being Jewish. He's demanding the right to be Jewish and not be part of this Netanyahu kind of, you know, picture that all Jews, you know, must support Israel and must support whatever Israel does and therefore must support Netanyahu. He's, you know, I think that is what he's refuting. But the phrasing is extremely easy to misrepresent. And of course, a lot of people in bad faith or just straightforwardly bad at reading comprehension, which is a lot of the internet.
And it's amazing how big an overlap there is between
those.
Yes,
there certainly is, have indeed swooped in. And I think that's the problem is, I mean, I think his sentiment, and actually it's really quite a balanced statement in the end, because he does, you know, he pays tribute. He says October the 7th was he condemns that. You know, so he's tried for balance, but it's that clumsy little beginning of the sentence phrase that is actually quite easy to misunderstand.
Just finally on this, Yossi, and if we forgive Jonathan Glazer his, you know, grammar at this point, but the sense of what he said as we understand it, in your experience, especially as Israel's offensive in Gaza has escalated, is this representative to you of conversations going on among Israelis, among the Jewish diaspora?
In what sense? Sorry.
In the sense that there are people irritated at being felt that they have to go along with this, or they are in some way betraying the state of Israel and what it represents.
It goes all the way back to the founding of the state, expecting the diaspora to support, come what may, Israel policies. And I think gradually this is changing, and definitely the war in Gaza is changing this, because many in the diaspora refuse to support this. Of course they support Israel and condemned October 7th, but they refuse to support what's happening right now in Gaza. And when talking about starvation, about so many people killed, I think many of us don't support it. And I think in this sense what Glazer said represented, again, Eddie just put it differently, I think it would, many, I think, in the communities, in Jewish communities around the world would actually follow what he says, except it.
Well, with an absolutely screaming
changing of gears. Today, March 20th, is International Happiness Day. So happy International Happiness Day to all who celebrate. It seems at first thought unfair that there isn't a designated International Misery Day, but we do have Christmas, which is probably near enough. As usual, International Happiness Day has been graced by the release of the annual World Happiness Report. And as usual, at least for the seventh year running, it declares that the happiest of all the world's nations is Finland. Well, a short while ago, Finland's ambassador to the United Kingdom, Jukka Suokkosari, desisted from the exuberant, gregarious revelry for which his people are famous to tell me what this astonishing run at the top means to him.
It's good to talk about happiness and the strong points of the Finnish society, so it is part of the job, and when the agenda is negative, the work is more pleasant.
How do the Finns, who are, of course, a famously restrained and taciturn people, celebrate being named the happiest people on Earth? Do you smile slightly, stand somewhat closer together than normal? What is the protocol?
Very good question. I presume that there would be more smiles on the people's faces than on average day in Finland. After all, it's also spring approaching and more sunshine and less grey surroundings. But of course, as you said, this is becoming a habit. So Finns were expecting to be number one. And of course, being the semi-pessimistic people we are afraid of losing the first position. So now we'll concentrate on defending what we have gained.
Well, this is something I am genuinely starting to wonder about. Would it be a kind of hideous downward spiral if Finland ever got knocked off top spot? Because you would then be unhappy about that, which would mean the following year you were even less happy. And where would it end?
I think we would be even more determined to get it back the following year. So I don't think that logic is true. But to be honest, it is, of course, a great pleasure to have this position again. And the discussion we had in Finland in the early years, which was pretty much centered around that it must be wrongly measured, has died out. So we have accepted the position as the happiest nation in the world.
Well, the question that then arises for the seventh year running is what actually is your secret? Is there one particular thing that it strikes you that Finns are this supernaturally happy about?
I don't think there is a magic potion or medicine that would explain the whole with one word or one sentence. I think it's a combination of many things. We talk about the infrastructure that enables happiness. So the society has over the decades and centuries evolved in a way that allows individuals to be happy or content in their everyday lives. And it's a combination of many things. Equality is one thing, of course. Trust in institutions, but also trust between citizens, closeness to nature, ability to interact not only with fellow human beings, but also the larger ecosystem and the world around us.
There's a couple of things there I did want to pick up on, particularly that aspect of trust in institutions, which I know is by global standards very high in Finland, and that's largely, as I've been able to understand it, with good reason, in that the institutions and the infrastructure and most things in Finland work. Is it actually that simple, that if you build people a functional state, then that will increase the general happiness?
Well, of course, it's easy to say that you build a state like that, but it's not easier said than done. So you have to have certain elements in place. I think one thing that we benefit from is that the public service or being a civil servant is still relatively valued as a career choice in Finland. So teachers, for example, who are employed by the municipalities, that profession is a very sought after profession. People want to become teachers. And it's also valued so in the society. And that brings then with it the willingness sort of to be part of the machinery, low levels of corruption. So that's another explaining factor. But how do you build that from scratch or when you start with a very low level trust in institutions is a very difficult question. And I don't have an answer to that.
That relative sense of equality you mention as well, is that important? The idea that I guess there's not really anybody to resent?
Yes, in a way, I would say that. I think one it begins at birth already. So every Finnish child has the same opportunities to succeed in life. A free education system or a non-payment education system, in the sense that it's paid from the taxpayers' pockets, is one part of that. But then also the equality between gender. And an interesting fact which I learned when I was studying the materials yesterday and today is that actually Finnish fathers spend more time with their children than any other developed nation. So that might be a lesson for my fellow fathers listening to you here, that think about that and think about what the importance of the family as a unit and both parents taking responsibility of their children has on happiness.
And just finally, Ambassador, if we think about this from your personal perspective, when you think about the country you come from and indeed the country you represent in the world, what is it about Finland that makes you especially happy to be a Finn?
I'm extremely happy about the fact that Finns are, in general, forward-looking. They invest in their future and in their children's future. We also take our national security very seriously, and that has been shown, of course, with the turbulent times that we are now witnessing with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So the nation sort of has a very strong sense of togetherness and also the will to defend the country if need be.
That was Finland's ecstatic ambassador to the UK, Jukka Jukkasaari. Let's bring our panel back in. Alex, it is the happiness index, the usual clean sweep for the Nordics. It's Finland ahead of Denmark, Iceland and Sweden, Norway at number 7. Are you consumed with jealousy when you think of the people of that part of the world?
I am when I think of their pensions and social security measures, yes.
Possibly less so when you think of their income taxes?
Well, you know, but on the other hand, I mean, look at all the stuff you get for it. You know, childcare and social provision and, you know, kind of job apprenticeships, all sorts of things.
That's enough of this crazed communist talk on the Monocle Daily.
I don't know. I suppose, I mean, I do have friends, particularly in Sweden, and, you know, of course, they've had quite a dramatic change of government recently. So mm-hmm. Who knows how long some of this stuff will last. Possibly they'll start slipping down the rankings. But I mean, they certainly, they're quite shocked when they come to Britain and see how few provisions we have, particularly in regard to childcare, actually. That's a huge one. But no, I think it's not really surprising, because I think in many ways those countries have, been able to balance the kind of social welfare with opportunity in a way that is rather impressive. And of course, in the case of Norway, they're also tremendously wealthy.
They are. The UK is clinging on at number 20. Australia is at number 10, which is one ahead of New Zealand, which gives us probably enough enough extra to be happy about that next year we'll be at number 9. Yossi, I'm not sure when these soundings were taken, but nevertheless, Israel at number 5. Does that surprise you?
I expected this question. I must say something, because you mentioned that I've been to Norway last week, and it surprised me. It was minus 1 degree, and I came and said, look how beautiful the spring is out there. And I said, I'm wearing my heaviest coat here and freezing. And they were so happy and so smiling, so someone is definitely there, and I think it thought we have quality. Yes, I'm quite shocked that it's at number 5, even if it took place before October 7, which obviously that it was the time that were hundreds of thousands of people protesting against the government and say how democracy... I mean,
maybe they were enjoying protesting against the government.
To me, since I've been twice in this protest, it was actually a very joyful event, but the issue of protesting was not as joyful as the protests themselves. But the idea that the country is going from crisis to crisis, people complain basically about everything and anything, and then... So, yeah, maybe it's the case. If I can complain, I must be happy. So that's the only conclusion I can.
Jossi Mackelberg and Alex von Sonsemann, thank you both for joining us. Finally, on today's show, the Lie Detectives in Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age is a new book by Sasha Eisenberg, Monocle's US politics correspondent, also a teacher at the UCLA, that is, Department of Political Science. In the book, Sasha assesses the phenomenon of disinformation, but in a practical way. He delves into how political campaigns campaigns can fight back at a time when our institutions, including the media, are faced with hostility by many voters. Monocle's US editor Chris Lord met Sasha Eisenberg at his home in Santa Monica and began by asking how disinformation is already making itself felt in the run-up to this year's US elections.
So I think everybody is on the lookout for how will the technological capabilities change the nature of disinformation this year. That could be the quantity of it. That could be the speed of disseminating, the scale, the scope. What's the role that AI is going to play? And particularly the new sophistication of deepfake video and audio. And we're seeing examples of this already. On the day of the New Hampshire primary, there was a fake Joe Biden who was recorded in an automated robocall going to New Hampshire voters saying, hey, the primary day has changed. Don't turn out and vote on Tuesday. It was a pretty good example of what somebody can do with, you know, off-the-shelf tools.
What a bunch of malarkey. We know the value of voting Democratic when our votes count. It's important that you save your vote for the November election. We'll need your help in electing Democrats up and down the ticket. Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again. Your vote makes a difference in November, not this Tuesday. If you would like to be removed from future calls, please press 2 now.
But it's really important to realize that some of the most persistent and pernicious forms of online disinformation in the United States and elsewhere were text-based. The QAnon conspiracy in the United States, Donald Trump's election denial, which is not just a particular piece of online disinformation, but has become a sort of complete conspiracy theory that shapes how believers see basically every force in U.S. life. These were things that were not supported by persuasive fake videos. These were created by what is a pretty old school way of getting people to believe in conspiracy theories, which is you start telling them a story that they want to believe and have it accord just enough with reality and just enough with sort of playing to their inclinations and instincts, and they start to buy it.
Sasha explains that one of the challenges in tackling disinformation is that it sits on a partisan fault line, with those on the right of politics often saying that efforts to rein in disinformation are an underhanded attempt to silence conservative voices online. The left, meanwhile, is often reticent about any new legislation in case it stokes fears about curtailing free speech. In The Lie Detectives, the narrative focuses on an American disinformation expert called Jory Craig, who began her career as a consultant to political campaigns in Gabon, the Philippines, Moldova, and elsewhere. Following the election of Donald Trump in 2016, however, she got a call from closer to home.
What happened after November 2016 was that this woman, who had never before worked on a domestic American political campaign, she's from Illinois, but she had never worked in American politics, starts getting phone calls from people in Washington, in prominent positions in the Democratic Party, at labor unions, tied to donors, who are saying, hey, we're trying to make sense of what just happened in this election. We're learning that there were these troll armies and bot farms that were attacking Hillary Clinton. This was all totally foreign to people in American politics. They knew a hell of a lot about every voter in the United States. They had all these ways of experimenting to measure what was effective and predict what would move certain voters. And now these political professionals in the wake of the 2016 election were having to confront the reality that there were all sorts of political communicators who had the ability to reach American voters and potentially sway them, whose objectives were not always clear. Some of the people who were engaging in, who were creating fake accounts on Facebook to spread news were not doing because they wanted to elect Donald Trump. They wanted to make money off of Facebook ad revenue. They wanted to have fun or create mischief. And Jory Craig became the person who explained to them how to think about all this. And that was because in these countries where she had worked on 4 or 5 different continents, a lot of the things that were new to American politicos were old hat, unremarkable.
Here in America and in the West, were we a little bit naive to this, really? We were sort of attached to an old, safe world where that didn't happen.
Yes, and you know, some of that is distinctive to the U.S., I think, in that so much of the American political model was tied up in the, we raise lots of money and we communicate over centralized channels, and the campaign is being run foremost by these sort of centralized political communicators, that model was disintegrating in 2016 in the US. And it was the fact that Jory Craig had worked in places where those things were entirely unremarkable, made her this incredibly valuable guide to thinking about the practical questions that faced American political communicators. So she became the person that, you know, the first real counter disinformation operative in American politics, and has done more than anyone to shape the way that at least the Democratic Party and it and the American left think about some of these problems.
Your book is subtitled as a playbook, a way of thinking about how to counter disinformation, how to tackle it in this world of politics. Ironically, you know, Jory's sort of one of her main things that she ends up telling a lot of these politicos that you say she's sat down with is do nothing.
The worst case scenario is that you end up amplifying or promoting it. The algorithms that disseminate and promote content online respond to engagement. Most of the examples we see, and that frankly are often surfaced now by kind of disinformation reporters in the media who are incentivized to find the most outrageous things that are circulating somewhere online and surface them, are finding things that are being followed by improbably small audiences. And so the challenge that people like Jory Craig have is convincing decision makers in campaigns, this could be elected officials, candidates, how to distinguish between the stuff that's just a nuisance and the stuff that's a real problem. In the US this year, I think the most underappreciated frontier in disinformation is, you know, there's increasing use of apps like WhatsApp, especially among immigrant communities in the US, Asian American, Latino immigrant communities. Getting visibility into them from campaigns and political communicators is really difficult. The challenge is that a lot of the institutions which once mediated truth, certainly in the United States, but I think versions of this are true in throughout the world, are weaker than they were. The deep disinformation problem that we face is, why are people so willing to accept lies online and focus more on who's welcoming them than who's putting them out?
That was Monocle's US editor Chris Lord speaking to Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha's new book is called The Lie Detectives. And that's all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Alex von Tonselman and Yossi Meckelberg. Thanks also to Pat Leahy at the Irish Times. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.